Good morning, everyone. It is so good to see you. It is so good to be here. It is so good to be on the way to heaven. That is something that is exciting, and I'm afraid that all too often it doesn't become exciting for us the way that it should be. We can talk about heaven, and we can talk about all of its virtues and how wonderful it would be to be there. But really, don't we need to be thinking of it in terms of how wonderful it is to be on our way there? That I'm actually on my way to heaven is something that is truly important to my attitude, with regard to getting to the destination, but more than that, with regard to my attitude with those who are around me and the way that I am going to encourage them. And so, this week, what we're going to be talking about is going to heaven and asking the question, do you want to go to heaven? Well, I want to go to heaven. And I believe that you want to go to heaven. I believe that's why you're here this morning. I believe that this is a part of the process. We're going to talk about that during the course of this week. What does it take to get to heaven? We're going to talk about our attitudes about heaven. And really, hopefully, by the end of this week, if I've done my job, you're going to be excited and truly want to be on your way to heaven even more than you have been before. And you're going to be looking for those opportunities to serve God the way that He wants you to serve Him. Tell you what, I've been looking forward to this week for quite some time, even before I knew what the titles were going to be, before I knew what the series was going to be. I don't remember exactly how long ago that Charles had contacted me, but I remember some anticipation, some eagerness, and then around the end of last year, this series kind of popped into my head, and I started sketching up titles, and I started brainstorming, And as this meeting approached, I started thinking, you know, I think maybe this series might be a good fit. And so as I worked up titles and I was working up the lessons anyway, when Charles contacted me about what we wanted to do this week, I suggested this series, told him what I had in mind by it, and he said, go ahead. And so I already had the outlines pretty much worked up. And the more I've worked on them, the more I've polished on them, the more I've slid them, as I call making slides for them, the more excited I've gotten about them. And so I hope you can be here for every service this week. I know some of the times life kind of steps in and creates problems. I hope if it does that, you'll get the CDs and you'll take this entire series. I am very glad that you're here for our Bible study this morning, because what we're going to do this morning in our Bible study is really, we are going to lay some groundwork for getting to heaven. We could title this lesson several different ways, and I've titled it a particular way for your advertising, but I have a title for it that's a lot longer than Brother Charles would have wanted to put on a flyer. And that is, the basis of every successful journey to heaven. That's what we need. We need to know what the basis for every successful journey to heaven is. And then we implement that basis into our lives in order to make it a reality. So the question is, what is the basis for every successful journey to heaven? Because let's face it, a lot of people talk about going to heaven, and as the old song says, everybody talking about going to heaven ain't going there. And that's very true. You can talk about going to heaven, but there's a different matter as to whether you're actually going there, whether you're going to get there, or whether you're just talking about it, and it's just something that sounds good. And some of the times we can get on a bandwagon and not really be going where we say we're going. The wagon's taking us the wrong direction. I'm going to invite your attention this morning to what perhaps might be obvious to you from the title within this series, and that is Hebrews chapter 11. We talk about Hebrews chapter 11. We talk about people who have gone before us. And I call these trailblazers. These are the ones who are trailblazers who show us the way. I want to know how to get to heaven. Have you ever had someone give you directions, maybe just give you an address? And even if you have GPS and you plug it in, there's still this little bit of trepidation. As you drive along and you're either following the directions and you're looking and you're straining to see where you're going, or you're listening to the directions and it's saying turn here, and you're wondering if how new this address is and whether GPS is going to take you down to a dirt road that ends, which I've had happen. But when you're following someone who's actually been there before, when you follow someone who has been successful, now you're looking at a trailblazer. You're following someone in whom you may have confidence. And having confidence in them, it's a relief. The only thing you have to do is you have to make sure you stay on their tail, because you don't want to lose them. And that's the problem we run into. We have in the scriptures trailblazers. Trailblazers who went before in their journey to heaven. What we want to do is we want to make sure that we don't lose them. They're leading the way, and now I have to make sure that I do not lose them. And so I want to begin here in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1, a passage that you are no doubt familiar with. The faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Now, this is interesting. The words that are used here by Paul, they seem like, well, we're just defining faith, and now we're going to go on and we're going to talk about people who had faith. But Paul's doing more than that here. In Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1, the Apostle Paul uses words that are actually going to ring through the remainder of this chapter. They don't stop at verse 1. They don't just lay a thought in your head and then you just go on and start talking about faith. For example, when we look at this substance here, faith is the substance of things hoped for. The word that he uses there is a word that was used for putting something underneath something else to hold it up. And, of course, we get our idea of sub, underneath, substance. It came to be used by them of not just holding something up, but holding it in a steady fashion, of giving assurance and confidence that whatever is on that will not topple, that it will not fall over. Now listen to what he says. He says, faith is what you have holding something up. Faith is the substance. It's what's holding up the things that are hoped for. We have something that we are hoping for. The key idea or concept in Hebrews chapter 11 is a destination. We might call it the city with foundations. Of course, we don't usually talk that way. We usually just say heaven. But we're talking about the same thing. The place that is hoped for is heaven. It is the city with, what does that say? Foundations. And I can't prove it, but I believe there's a play on words there. Because remember, faith is the substance. It's what's underneath holding up things hoped for. I'm hoping for a city, but what does the city have? The city has foundations. There may be a play on words there. I can't say that for sure. Some of the times puns and plays on words kind of pop out, but I suspect there's a play. We're looking for that city, and it has foundations. And you know what the foundation is for us? It's our faith. It holds it in all assurance. Now, this word here, it came to indicate the confidence that a person has as a result of that. Assurance, some of the newer translations. For example, I use the New American Standard Version, even though I quote it out of the King James Version because I like that wording better. The New American Standard Version says, faith is the assurance of things hoped for. That is the result of that substance, of that which is underneath holding it up. It gives assurance. In the mind, there is great confidence because that is the case. But now there's another word here that I want you to notice here. He says, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Now, the word that he uses here for evidence is interesting. This is a word that in the Greek referred to the idea of proving something. So that makes sense to us, doesn't it? To present evidence is to prove something. And so it is the evidence of things not seen. But it also has, you know, it's one of those words that can be used in two different ways. And so it may be used of the conviction that comes about on the basis of the evidence. And thus, in newer translations, you'll see that instead of evidence, that it is the conviction of things not seen. But now I want you to put this verse together. Look at it for just a moment and notice that faith is the substance or the assurance or the confidence of things hoped for. Things hoped for are things that we want, that we desire, that we have a reason to expect, and yet we've not realized them yet. There are things that we hope for in our lives, and when we say hope, it's not that they're a pipe dream. It's not that they're a wish, pie in the sky kind of wish. But instead, they're something that we are expecting and we are hoping to attain them. That's what heaven is, or it should be, for us. It's not pie in the sky. It's not something that we really don't think we're going to attain. It's something that we have expectation of, but we haven't gotten there. The author of Romans in Romans chapter 8 speaks of it in this particular way with regard to the faith and the hope that an individual might have. But he says that faith is this assurance or this confidence in things that are hoped for. Things that are hoped for are not things that are without any conviction within our hearts. But then he talks about the evidence of things, listen to it, not seen. Not seen. How can you have an evidence of something that is not seen? And this is the important function of faith in our lives. So often people get the idea that faith is something that really you have no reason to believe in it, but you believe in it against all odds, that maybe, just maybe somehow, it might actually be true. That, my friend, is not faith. Faith has a confidence that is attached to it. It has a conviction that is actually attached to it. And it is in something that is actually not seen. You know, in our day and age, faith is something that is very much taken for granted. You know, I see people fritter their lives away on things that don't even exist. Young people, I'm not picking on you, and none of the young people here may even fall into this category. But think for a moment, those of you who kind of have your finger on the pulse, think about this zombies craze. This craze for vampires. There's not a single solitary shred of evidence that a zombie or a vampire or a witch or a warlock exists on the face of this earth. And I'm not talking about someone in a coven of Wiccan. You know, they couldn't put a curse on you if their life depended on it. They could say it, but it won't have any effect. I'm talking about the Harry Potter kind of witches. And it's interesting to me that people can spend so much time obsessing about something that does not exist. But then you start to talk about heaven. Then the zombies really begin to exist. Because you watch them in the pew and you see the arms fold. And then what happens next? The eyes glaze over. Yeah, now you've got some real zombies, let me tell you. Now, something's wrong here, because somebody can get excited about something that does not exist, but when you talk about something that not only does exist, but something that they can attach themselves, something that they can make their reality, and all of a sudden they turn into what they're afraid of. What we need to do is we need to understand this process of faith where you may believe in zombies, you don't have any reason to. That's not believing. That's fantasy. Pure and simple, that's fantasy. When we talk about heaven, we have reason to believe. Drop to verse 3 here in Hebrews chapter 11. After saying that men of old gained approval, he says, by faith we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God. You remember the beginning. And God said, and over and over again, it was the word of God saying that brought the world into existence. Out of nothing, everything came to be, and it was by the word of God. But I want you to notice here in verse 3, he is saying that it is by faith that we understand that. Now somebody looks at that and they say, well now Bob, how is that any different than believing in zombies? Well first of all, you don't have any reason other than someone's imagination that a zombie even exists. And second of all, when I look at the world around me, I've got something. I can pinch myself and I hurt. I can pinch you and you can say, ow, and tell on me. You want to know something? I can look at the worlds around me. I see the order of creation. Turn on the weather channel. They'll tell you what time sunrise is and what time sunset is. And by the way, here's a funny thing. People look at the Bible and they say, you know, the Bible, if it really understood things about the way the world was made, you know what? It wouldn't talk about sunrise and sunset because the sun doesn't really go anywhere. The earth spins. You want to know something? I turn on the weather channel. And I have a bunch of atheists talking to me about sunrise and sunset. Go figure. Go figure. It's an accommodative out of that which is apparent. It looks like it rises. So we speak that way. Did you wake up this morning and wonder if the sun would rise? You didn't wonder about that, did you? You turn on that same channel, it'll tell you whether the tide's going in, whether it's going out, and it will tell you when. You know why they can know when? Because everything is orderly. The timing of the seasons, everything is exactly right. We know exactly how much time is in a year. And no, it's not a 365 days. It's not exactly correct. It's a little bit off from that, and that's why you get a leap year every 4 years. But we know exactly how long everything is. We were able to make an atomic clock that you may have an atomic clock at home. It's not actually an atomic clock. It works off of the atomic clock. It receives a radio signal, and it keeps correcting itself because an atomic clock that the Naval Observatory or the Air Force or whoever it's running off of, it has the correct figure, and it sends it to yours. How can they know that? Because everything has a design to it. You know something? I turn on the TV, and if I pick up a channel that has a zombie on it, all I'm looking at is an imagination. Someone's imagination, and they're making money off of it. But I look at the world around me, and I see something that has order, it has design, and I have reason to believe there's a designer. There's a designer. I have a watch on my hand. This is Paley's argument. So you say, well, that's an old argument. Yeah, but Paley had a great argument. It was a great argument. And here's why. Someone made that watch. And you don't doubt that. And it's not simply because I can look at the face and it says, oh, it says Armatron. So I know who made the watch. Well, that doesn't mean anybody made it, does it? Well, maybe not. Consider the fact that this watch is extremely accurate. You know, the people keep resetting the clock back home in the church building. And someone gets up, and I look down at my watch, and there's still 2 minutes left. Why are they up there? And I go look, and someone changed the clock. Okay. I set my clock off the Naval Observatory time. I know that my watch is correct. And I check, and I see, well, maybe I'm off. And I go and I say, no, it's exactly right. How does my watch keep perfect time? Someone designed it to do that. You want to know something? I have faith in this. I have faith in this because it has proven itself over time. I look at the world around me and I have faith, a certain amount of faith in what is around me because it has proven itself over time. And no one, you know, the meteorologists on the various weather bureaus, they don't wonder whether anything's going to change about all of this. They know good and well it is all constant, it is all consistent. But you know what that is? That's design. When you talk to me about faith and whether or not I have faith that there is a God and whether or not that is reasonable, it's perfectly reasonable. You would think I was insane if I said that my watch just washed up on the shore down in Galveston one day, and I was walking along the beach, and I found it. And I picked it up, and I said, oh, look what evolved out of the water. Over millions of years, minerals formed as storms worked their way over the surface. And they churned the water, and the minerals came together, and they made the various parts and the gears and the wheels and even the electronics. And guess what? They'd even charged the battery. You want to know something? I look at this watch, and I see that it has, guess, the correct time on it. How did it have the correct? Well, the time just evolved on there. But you want to know what is even more amazing about that? What is even more amazing about that is that it keeps perfect time. It's never wrong, and it just keeps it perfectly. Now, that's absurd, isn't it? That's what someone wants me to believe about the biggest clock in the universe, and that's our solar system. Our solar system is the biggest clock that we have, and someone wants me to believe it just happened. It just happened. The truth is, by faith, we understand that God set all of this in motion by His Word. So at the very beginning here, I have reason to believe. Now, our author in Hebrews, he's not talking to a people who do not believe these scriptures that he's going to be pointing out. He's talking to Jewish Christians who've been pulling back from Jesus because they're being persecuted. And they think that they can go back to the law of Moses. You see, they're not forsaking these scriptures that our author goes to. They think they can go back to the law of Moses, still serve God acceptably, because after all, God did give that law to Moses, as Paul put it in Galatians 3:19, by the agency of angels through a mediator. And so, word spoken by angels, good enough, just going back to chapter 1 of Hebrews. And our author says, no, it's not. The word spoken through angels was good then. But you know, when they disobeyed, they received a just recompense. He says, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? What great salvation? The great salvation of one who has been made greater than the angels, exalted to the right hand of God, this Jesus. And so what our author is doing, he's going back to Old Testament passages for people who believe the Old Testament, and he's saying, look at these people. Now, when we talk about faith, I believe in God. I have never seen God. I believe in Jesus. I believe he's at the right hand of God. I've never seen Jesus. I've never seen him at the right hand of God, but I believe he is there, and there's a reason why I believe he is there. Evidence, remember our word here in verse 1? Evidence is placed before me, but faith has reacted to that with a conviction. We live in a society that depends on this. Let's say for a minute that Benjamin here is accused of doing something terrible. We'll just make it really bad. We'll just say that Benjamin was in Walmart and he stole something. Okay? He's accused of that, and he is brought up for trial. Now, all of you can go down and can say, listen, we know him, we have known him. You could even say, we have known him since the day he was born. He would never do this. Do you think they would let him go on that basis? They're not going to do it. See, the truth is, the court system works on a presumption of innocence. Law enforcement works on a presumption of guilt, and people sometimes miss that. It has to be that way, by the way. They would never catch a criminal if they never suspected anybody, right? Okay, so they've got Benjamin. They think he's guilty. By the way, Benjamin, I don't think you're guilty either. They think he's guilty. How are they going to determine one way or the other? It's exactly the same way as when you read your Bible and you determine right and wrong as far as what God says. It's called the inductive method of interpretation. Our modern system of jurisprudence depends on the idea of presenting evidence in a case, of wiping the slate, of clearing the mind, having no preconceived notions. And if you're going in on the jury, you're not going to be able to sit on the jury because you already believe he's innocent. They want people who just have no conviction whatsoever in the matter, and then evidence will be presented. The district attorney will come. The assistant district attorney will come. They are going to tell you, okay, here is what we have. Here is the evidence before us. And you will have to determine what you believe in the matter. You've never met the young man. You don't know anything about the young man as the journey. And yet, you're going to make a decision. How can that be? You don't have to have seen him either steal or not steal. You can still make a decision, can't you? It's based on evidence. And that's what we're talking about with the Bible. That's what we're talking about with these people right here. We're talking about the conviction of things not seen. Things that are not seen. Look as we drop down to verse 7 here. By faith, Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen. Have you ever noticed that? Verse 1 was not an accidental wording. We're not going to go through all of these cases here in Hebrews 11, but each and every one of them, whether it actually spells out the idea of not seeing or not, it contains this idea of believing on the basis of not seeing. You have not seen something, and yet you have conviction. There is evidence in your mind, and you hold it up, and you have an assurance of it. And this faith, it props up underneath you, and it's based upon a reasonable conclusion that you have drawn. So faith is what Noah had. How does God come to Noah and say there's going to be a flood? Indication seems to be there'd never been a flood before. If there's never been a flood before, then you don't have a word, do you? I mean, what does the word flood mean to Noah? In whatever language he was speaking, what does the word flood? Because they've never had one. And so, undoubtedly, the fact that God said the waters will become a flood to destroy the earth, in some way he defined it, and now we know what a flood is. First one's coming. And so we have Noah here, something that it would seem has never taken place before is going to happen. Did Noah believe? It's a good thing he did, because no one would have made it otherwise. Someone had to prepare the ark. And so by faith, Noah did this. Look at the next verse. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. Listen to it. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. What is that? He doesn't say that he hasn't seen it before, but I can guarantee you there were no travel brochures for him to look at and to say, I want to go to Canaan. You understand that when our author here says that he didn't know where he was going, it was something unseen. He had no idea other than the fact that God said, go, and Abraham believed. My beloved, this is the position that we are in. Abraham was in a place that he knew, and he knew very well. And God was saying, get up and go to a place you have never seen. How is that different than what you and I are being asked to do? We have all around us a place that we understand, that we know, that we love. I love living in the Houston area. Some people say I'm crazy. And there are aspects of it that I'm not real crazy about. But I love living here. But God says, get up and go somewhere. What that means is that there are places in Houston I will not go. I will detach myself from them because they are not the kinds of places that behoove an individual who loves righteousness to go. Things to do, places to see, people to be with. There are things about this world that I have to get up and get away from in order to go where God is telling me to go. Yes, there is a difference in that I am not physically traveling as into another land, but yet there is something physical about it, isn't there? And it is my physical reaction to what God has said. So here I have Abraham, and here is a place that he has not seen. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. This is what Hebrews chapter 11 is about. And what our author is doing is he is trying to instill two ingredients into his readers.
And these are two ingredients that you need and I need. No doubt about it. And you already know the first ingredient. I hope. Faith. If I do not believe there is a heaven, I will not try to go there. If I do not believe that the Bible has the answer, I will not use it to try to go there. I will look around for something else to tell me how to get to whatever the heaven is I conceive of there being, nirvana or whatever it might be. And I will find another way. I must have faith. I must believe. And the question is, do I believe? I'll tell you about the other ingredient in just a moment. In verse 10, we find that Abraham was looking for a city. It has foundations, but he had not seen that city. And yet he believed it was there. How do I know he believed it? Because he was looking for it. He was looking for something that he could not see. Is that not us when we talk about heaven? I want to go to heaven. But what I am saying is I want to go somewhere that I have not seen. Some place that I must accept by faith. Look at verse 13 here. In speaking of the patriarchs here, he says, "These all died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth." Did you hear what he said there? He said that these people who did not receive the promises and they couldn't actually see what they were going for, what they were looking for, what they were trying to attain, they couldn't see it. Yet he still says here, having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance. What our author here is saying is something that we say in different words. We speak of seeing by faith or having eyes of faith, don't we? It's exactly what we're talking about right here. These people were journeying with eyes of faith. They could see something, but they saw it in the promises that they believed in, but without the believing, they would not have made the journey. Look at verse 27. We talk about Moses. And notice here that we're told that by faith he, Moses, left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. Listen to it. For he endured as one, as seeing him who is unseen. Unseen. There's that word again. That's what faith is about. We cannot see these things, and yet there must be a faith, there must be a conviction, there must be a belief. Sometimes you hear people say, if I could see God, I would believe. Sometimes you hear it like this. You know, if I could see Jesus, just for a minute, if I could see Jesus, I would believe. They're wrong. They're absolutely, positively, without a doubt, I can prove that they are wrong. Let me show you with a simple illustration. And put your phone away. Don't call my wife or text her. She's in Bible class. I do not believe in my wife. Now, you could take that more than one way. I'm going to tell you how to take it in just a minute. But think about this for just a moment. I do not believe in my wife. I don't have to believe in her. I know her. I know her. It is things that you have not seen that you believe in. Things that you have seen, you know. You don't need faith for something that you've seen. I don't need faith for something I kissed goodbye this morning. I know that my wife exists, and I don't have to believe she does because I know she does. If I see God, then I don't believe in God. I know that He is. I know that he is in the sense of that which is experiential, what I've experienced. Seeing Jesus no longer becomes a matter of faith when you actually lay your eyes on him, when in some way your senses have actually taken hold of him. No longer is there faith. People talk about needing to see. They have to see. This was the promise with Thomas, with the other disciples. They had the same problem a few days before because they didn't believe either until Jesus came in. But Thomas was worse because he had the word of the other 10 disciples and he should have believed what they had to say. But he didn't. And he had to touch. He had to reach and touch and then he would believe. But you know, Thomas, you're wrong. You need to have faith without touching because faith with touching is knowing. And Jesus points out that there is something inferior in that. Now we talk about salvation by faith today. We're talking about the ability to draw this conviction based not upon what you see as far as seeing Jesus, but instead examining the evidences and drawing the conclusion from those. What did Paul say in Romans 10:17? Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. What do we have here? We have evidences. It's like a court of law, and you're a member on the jury. And now you're looking at the evidences of the word of God, and those evidences are presented to you in a logical, orderly manner, in fact, in a verifiable manner, if you want to go back to history and see if Jesus ever really existed, if he ever stood before Pilate, if he was actually crucified. These are things that are completely verifiable. Christianity's beginnings, it began very, very early as opposed to what the skeptic says, and you can see that in history. I look back at history, secular history itself, and it says, you better listen to this. You better sit up and listen to the evidences and think very seriously. People who say, well, I need to see Jesus, they're basically saying, I think God is doing this wrong. You know, he would have the whole world believing if he would just appear. Jesus would appear and everyone would believe and everything would be all right. But you know, God needs a test. He needs to know if we really want to go to heaven. And he needs to know if we're really willing to listen to reason. And just seeing isn't going to do that. It's not going to do it at all. Now, running out of time very, very fast. I'd better get to the second ingredient, right? The first ingredient we find is faith. The second ingredient is a result of faith. And this is really what our author is going for in this chapter. He's already been talking about faith in the book of Hebrews, going about how Jesus is better. He is sufficient to do that which God needed to do, but the law of Moses, the word of angels, these things were not sufficient. But Jesus is better. He accomplishes this. So we need this faith. But when we come to chapter 11, what we need is we need for that faith to do something else. An ingredient that reacts, kind of like baking soda or yeast, if you will, in a recipe. We need for it not to simply be there or create flavor or something. What we need is we need for it to do something. Chapter 10. It's a pity that chapter 11 begins where it does, although we kind of like that. But we actually need to understand that this reaches back to chapter 10, where we're actually told what these people needed and what our author wanted them to understand. Here we find him saying, "For you have need of endurance," verse 36. "You have need of endurance so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised." These people were not holding on. They were not enduring. They were not getting all the way. It's like running a race and you get halfway and you decide, well, this is too hard. I think I'll stop right here. Do they come up to you and say, "There, there, that's okay. Let me give you first prize anyway"? It doesn't happen, does it? And we don't expect that to happen. I believe that Christianity is the only, absolutely positively, the only discipline of thought where people can imagine that you don't even try and you still get first prize. When I look here, I find a people who were not enduring, and they needed to. They needed to endure, but in order to endure, they needed faith. And so our author is encouraging them to have the faith. To have faith in what? That which is unseen, so that they with that faith may endure and hold out. Drop back into chapter 11. Back into chapter 11. By the way, I might, maybe I can get this in a minute and a half. Think about Enoch back in verse 5 of chapter 11 here. And we look at Enoch and we say, you know, Enoch was translated. Wouldn't that be great to get out of this life and to go to heaven and not have to die? And so Enoch was not, for he was taken. Oh, that's an incredible way. Boy, I wish I could go that way. You know how long Enoch had to wait for that? Enoch had to wait 365 years to get that. You want to be faithful to God that long? I'd rather trust in the grace and mercy of God in Jesus Christ to get me there. I guarantee you, I've already messed up. Okay? So, dropping here to verse 13 of chapter 11, he says here, all these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance, having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth, for those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they had went out, they would have had an opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is an heavenly. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Endurance. My friends, there are two ways, two fundamental ways that Satan gets us. Two fundamental ways that Satan gets us. The first can be seen in your New Testament in what was happening to those saints in the first century. All of the persecution and all of the trials. What did that do? That created dissatisfaction. That's the first way that Satan does it. They all come down to dissatisfaction. But he creates dissatisfaction by depriving, by making you feel like you want. And therefore, you need to get away from this faithfulness to Jesus thing. And that's the problem that these people that the Hebrew writer was writing to, that's the problem that they had. They were being persecuted, and so they didn't have the endurance. They wanted to get rid of the persecution. The second way, you know, we look back there and we say, we don't have that problem. The second way Satan works is he makes us happy with what we have. He either takes everything away or he gives you everything. And either way, he has something on you. Because when he gives you everything, it's never enough. You can never become satisfied, but more than that, you become distracted. What happens is we get heaven on earth. We have everything we want. We have a comfortable home. I'm not saying these things are wrong. Central heating and cooling. You young people, that hadn't been around as long as you may think it has. A car to get somewhere. I can't imagine how early I would have had to have gotten up this morning to get here on a horse. I don't even want to calculate that. My horse is a red Toyota, and I am so thankful I have it. I'm thankful it's paid off. And I'm going to drive it until it drops, and I have to put a bullet in its, wherever you put a bullet in a car when it goes. We have clothing that is very nice. I don't buy top of the line, but I try to buy stuff that at least looks like it's top of the line. We have so much that is ours, and it's like heaven on earth. And you know how Satan has us? He has us
Because he makes us stop saying this right here. He makes us stop saying it in the way we act, not in what we say with our mouth. Because you see, you and I, we can say, I want to go to heaven. The truth is, everybody talking about going to heaven ain't going there. And we can say, I want to go to heaven, but that doesn't make it so. The reality of all of this comes down to the lives that we live. And so in the next hour, we're going to talk about reality. What is real? Everything that you have around you is very, very real, isn't it? I hope to give you a different perspective on what real truly is. I thank you for your attention.